Bandwidth for MacBreak Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
You're listening to MacBreak Tech.
Hello, world.
We now join a conversation already in progress.
Wow, hello world page is something else.
Isn't that cool? It's the coolest thing. There's a hello world page that has 199 languages listed on it that have an example of hello world.
Oh, right. And yes, I was looking through that. And it's actually pretty cool.
And it just goes on and on and on forever. It's funny because like all the major things are up there, so you don't have to go and figure out what, where, when.
It's even got ones for MUDs. It's got an IRC hello world timer/timer(1,9999)(1,hello(world) !!
I'm sure there's a batch file for hello world for DOS.
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm sure there's a dot. There's one for Emacs.
It is DOS batch file.
There is no automator hello world.
That's just
it's too new.
The automator hello world is no big deal because all you're doing is display a dialog that says hello world with an OK box on it.
Right.
Right. It's still hello world, right?
For completeness, yeah.
Yeah, for completeness. There's a thing that a guy put on Google Earth. It's a symbol code that he made so that you can actually see it from a satellite for hello world.
Oh my gosh.
There's a Flickr sat that shows how he made it and what it looks like from the air. And then there's a link to the Google map.
What is it, the bits to spell hello world or
no? Well, it's the symbol code thing. I don't know how it works.
Oh, GIS code.
Yeah. Oh, is that what it is? Yeah. Oh, okay. Nice.
It's funny.
Oh, to have some farmland at your disposal to do these things with,
or not have permission and just do it anyway.
I guess so.
Yes, I turned my cornfield into hello world.
There's a the O'Reilly guys have this really awesome poster that has the entire history of languages all the way back to the very first ones. So from a studying point of view, you can go, oh, well, that's how this is related to this. And this is why I don't like this language, because it's based on this other language that I don't like.
That language sucks.
Well, and that's really the thing that, you know, sometimes when you look at a language that's a utilitarian language that should be, that's, for example, Forth is a really blazing fast language, but it's reverse. It's kind of RPN, reverse Polish notation based. Mm-hmm. And so if you get Forth, you really like Forth. Mm-hmm. But if you don't get it, you're like, ugh.
I find myself being drawn to languages that somebody who's not me is going to get really quickly. At some point in the future when they inherit my crappy code, it just seems like inherently, you know, so many projects are some group that was not you or some person that was not you did something and you need to then enhance it later.
Right.
And languages that make, I don't know if that's necessarily an attribute of a given language, but at least coding styles and languages that are easily readable in that fashion, I don't know. It just seems like it saves so much time versus just something that's super cool, super terse,
right?
And yet harder for someone else to get into.
Well, a good example is Perl, right? How many Perl projects have you inherited where you look at it and go, it's faster to rewrite it?
Right.
Just from the ground. I could rewrite this in any number of things, including Perl, and fix this problem faster than fixing this code.
Yeah.
Let me just start over here and, yeah.
The issue, I don't know, the thing is that a lot of people ask me about how to get started being a programmer.
Mm.
So the discussion on the way home the other night from the yacht club,
yes,
was how do I get started being a game programmer?
Mm.
Mm.
Okay, so this is a huge problem, right? Where to start?
Right.
And so if you've never programmed, if you've never done the art for this, you know, you have this, oh my gosh, I don't even know where to begin.
Right.
So, you know, it was like, So as, you know, we're driving back, it occurs to me that you basically have to break that. A, you have solved the first problem, which was, where do I start?
Yeah, what am I going to do?
Right.
And what's my motivation to do it at all?
Right. So in this case, the kid says, I want to learn how to program games. Mm-hmm. Okay, awesome. Now we can have a conversation about what possibly is best and, you know, where to go.
Right.
And that. And so, you know, from there, it's like, okay, it doesn't matter what you choose. It doesn't absolutely, you know, it's like you could program it.
Well, it does matter to a certain level.
No, I'm going to say that it doesn't. I think that you have to start your trip somewhere, right? And right. So pick something, right? Pick Flash, pick Real Basic, mm-hmm. pick.
Do a mod on some, you know, one of the existing platforms.
Right.
A lot of that's code's just there, and it's people who are getting into languages. You know, it may not be the easiest way to get in from a language learning perspective, but you've got such a body of code to use as examples.
And so that was the point, is that if you pick something that has, say, a ton of examples, like, for example, Real Basic is a good, if nothing else, for the fact that there's 150 different examples of games that people have submitted back and say, here's my source code so that you can look at how to play tic-tac-toe.
Right.
Right.
Flash, did you mention Flash earlier?
Oh, yeah, Flash also.
Flash is a great one, too, because for games specifically, half the battle is getting all of your visual assets in there and displaying where you want them into. And Flash makes that kind of easy in that you just populate your story or whatever. What do they call the stage? Yeah. You get all your assets in there. Then you actually program to move them around and stuff. But the actual get this into the environment and put it somewhere where I can start playing with it is a lot. The barrier to entry there is a lot lower than it might be with something else.
Well, and you can use lots of, I mean, Flash automatically understands things like alpha channels. So if you put a bitmap in, you don't have to go and figure out how to, you know, make the graphics engine knock back the alpha.
Sure.
And then it can do more of what you want it to do. Another example, we even talked about this before, was Quartz Composer. Right? Using that as the basis for the thing that you're going to program. And then, you know, based on that, you've got a really great tool for doing your editing. You know, the IDE or the integrated development environment is all composed in the same place.
And that visual programming model allows you to sort of concentrate on the doingness of each of those nodes as opposed to how do I need to express this.
Right.
You can get the sort of flow issues and looping and those sorts of things in your head without necessarily needing to deal with the particular syntax.
Right. Yeah. So if you're starting from zero, you might as well start there. Like, you know, because programming is such a, it's not hard, but there's certainly structure to it. And there's certainly a bunch of rules. And so if you happen to be learning the English language, for example, you can butcher that all day long and people will still understand what you're trying to do. But if you're butchering Basic, all you're going to get is syntax error in line 8.
Right.
It's going to try and do exactly what you told it to do, which is something it doesn't understand.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. So,
but you have to understand what you're telling it to do in some cases to understand where the problem is.
Right.
The difficulty in programming, too, seems to me to be very context specific. I mean, once you get over the initial hurdle of learning the basic sort of programming concepts that all languages have, then what is hard is the domain you're working in. You know, am I doing distributed computing across a cloud of a bunch of different machines, or am I just making something in the terminal parse some text and spit out the result of, you know, some sort of manipulation?
So just to follow up on what you just said, every language is fundamentally the same. They have a math component. They can compare this with that. They have branching so that you can say, if I compare this with that, I'm going to go to there. I have a concept of looping. Whether I make that concept of looping by my, you know, using the other two compare and branch capability, and the math part. And then there's variables.
Storage.
I'm loading things into this register, or I'm loading this thing into an accumulator to do some math.
Depending on the language, to how high level it is, most of the modern language is either in the language itself or in some sort of library that's common that comes with it. There's the idea of collections too, which is really nice because you can think of things in groups. I've got a group of these things, and it's not necessarily just variables. It's It's collections of a various type of data that you can manipulate.
Well, and in modern language, the variable becomes an object. So you can have this thing called a bat, for example, and bat has a bunch of properties: how hard it is, what color it is, the properties, how long it is.
I was thinking of the other type of bat. I always use that as my parent class for all my always subclassing bat.
Suddenly you and I were not having the same conversation.
You get the echolocation built in, without needing to re-implement that again and again.
Well, the idea
batter, swing.
The idea is that modern, and a good example of this is when they added this concept to director in the Lingo language. Lingo suddenly became really fun to program in because you had these storage. One variable could have a bunch of stuff in it, so you didn't have to go remembering where things were.
Right.
Well, I think an issue that when people jump into programming too is that they have to kind of understand that some languages deal with data and what they're trying to create in different ways, in the sense that there's object-oriented programming, there's, more structured, linear style, and when people first jump in, sometimes those concepts can be daunting to them. If I have to say, I have to reference this thing over here because this is part of this, and where does that come from, and how does it actually know that? I mean, I know I've tried to teach people programming before, and the biggest hurdle, and even for me sometimes, when I first was learning like C++, was like, wait a minute, how am I getting this? Where is it coming from? I mean, what things does the syntax or the structure I'm using, what does it already understand, and what do I have to create? And sometimes I find that to be the biggest hurdle for people is, well, how do you know when you have to create it and when you can use what's existing?
That level of abstraction is always the pre-hurdle that once folks are over that seems to be, in my experience, one of the biggest things is that you're not, and in a strange way, the object-oriented stuff tends to be a little easier to get heads around because you can sort of create this physical analog to something that you're modeling, where it is a bat or a bat, as opposed to just a variable floating in this, a label for some data. You're actually talking about, I have a collection of bats and I'm going to do something, I'm going to swing each of the bats. That makes more sense than just doing something over an array of abstract data.
Right. And when was the very first time you ever got the concept of an array?
Probably needing to deal with them in ASP way back in the day, were there collections? It's hard to remember what existed when we started, but
the thing that was the weirdest thing was on it when I was learning, because I did all this, my non-formal training for programming was a basic interpreter. I played, I was making different games, or actually I was typing games in from the Creative Computing book called Basic Games. Okay, and so here's this idea of a dimension, of an array. So you the command is dim, open paren, and then the size of the array. So 5, 5. And so now you've got this thing. And if you draw that on a piece of paper, you get it. But the very first time you see this in code, you're like, what does that mean?
Right. Yeah, making the leap that it's a table, essentially, not intuitive at first.
And then being able to go and grab stuff from that table.
Right.
And having the coordinates to be able to go and then it becomes a fundamental program tool that you use all the time in other things.
Well, and those are the concepts that I think are sometimes the hardest ones for people to learn, especially if people are coming from it. And I find this all the time with people that learn Flash as an animation tool, or they hear, oh, I got to learn Flash, and they look at Flash as a front end, and in essence, kind of like you were saying, Ben, they learn the object side. They learn how to create the container itself, in essence, that might hold it, like a button or a video clip or something that's in there, but then making that object or that container active and giving it abilities or the sense of communication, that's when people are like, okay, now how do I go about doing that?
Right.
And do I use an array? What are these arrays? Or how do I make these guys talk with each other? And sometimes that's where, an array is basically a list. And if you number that list, you just go down that list and, okay, I want item 5 out of the list.
Right.
And
starting off in simple concepts a lot of times for me is where I get people into that. It's like, okay, let's not even think about programming. Let's think of a grocery list. I want to go out and go shopping, and I need to prioritize the list. Well, I'm not going to get my frozen food up front in that list, so I'm going to prioritize that lower in the list. I'm going to go around maybe to the produce area and to my canned goods and my dry goods, and then I'm going to get frozen at the end. So
a loaf of bread, a stick of butter, and
what is that from?
What's the last
thing? From the Sesame Street?
Yeah, a loaf of bread, a stick of butter, and I don't know. I don't remember.
They have a vague recollection.
Well, the thing with Flash is that a lot of people see it as an animation tool, and it hasn't been until recently, and it was when within the last two revisions of Flash that they said, "Hey, we have something that's really amazing here. So let's put the brains behind it so that the IDE can actually support people writing real programs and doing real code in this."
Mm-hmm.
It's not just this little one-liner thing where you basically have to use a whole other editor and then paste your script. Remember when you had to do that? Ugh, it's the worst. And then not really having a great debugger. You know, all the problems that went with the original early versions of Flash kind of went away. And now Flash is actually something that you can do real app development in, and a lot of people do.
And actually, I would almost say that in a sense, because the language behind Flash is ActionScript, of course, and the ActionScript 3, the latest version, in some ways goes almost so far into object-oriented programming that artists who are jumping in now, like, oh, I got to start here, are finding it harder than ActionScript 1 or 2, which was not quite a ultra-structured programming language like it's become, in essence.
Right.
So I almost find that people are having a harder time jumping into it now because of the structuring of the language in some ways.
You can still make it do just listy kind of things, though.
Yep, no.
You don't have to use its objectness if that makes it easier for you to learn.
No, I definitely agree with that, too. So,
all right, well, teach yourself or a class. What's the better way to go for the knobs? Noobs.
I'd say a mixture of, well, maybe not a formal class, but a mixture of both. I've found that with this stuff, diving in and figuring out what the problems are often makes even going through a primer that much more useful than just plowing through a book from start to finish. If you're really banging your head against some aspect of, like you were saying earlier, some real project that you're trying to get done, and you're using it, you sort of get your feet wet. Maybe you're cribbing code from somewhere else. Maybe you're looking at a bunch of examples and cutting and pasting to get going. But after that, then you're going back and reading through a primer, or even just going through various chapters to fill in gaps in your knowledge or whatever. It seems like that, in my experience anyway, has been the fastest approach to incorporating something new that I didn't know before, whether it be a new library or a language.
Okay.
Right. Start with a problem that you have to solve. Don't just, say, I'm going to learn ActionScript. Well, you're just learning a bunch of commands and libraries. You're not necessarily learning anything about problem solving. And that's really what programming is about, right? It's solving a problem, figuring out how to structure whatever language you're using into solving that problem or performing an action.
That to me, anyway, has always been the most fulfilling part of programming is and getting better at it over time is knowing that if I have, since so many of the things we're trying to do these days can be solved, it's an information problem or it's data related or whatever, being able to know that you can create the tool if one doesn't exist, or you can take existing tools and glue them together in a certain way.
Right.
It's a really empowering thing because then you're not just stuck pulling stuff off the shelf. And it's not, I think as you were saying, it's not that difficult to get at least the level of skill where you can be pushing stuff together with glue or writing simple programs or whatever. It becomes less sort of churning out code factory style and more I'm getting stuff done that I need to get done, and I'm maybe writing the tools that are lacking. And if you are so inclined, you're sharing them with the outside world as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We did when I was teaching at the art school, one of the students had this project, and it was a Flash-based thing. Mm-hmm. And what we needed to do was get something from a server to this Flash piece.
Mm.
So he was like, well, I don't even know how to do that. You know, because Flash certainly didn't do it at the time by itself. And so we discovered that you could actually pass variables to Flash using metadata. in the page. And so that was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. How do we get the metadata there? Turns out that you could send a request from Flash to a web page and then get it returned. So it was really easy to just take the PHP stuff, have it talk to the MySQL database, and then jam that back to as the reply to the HTTP request that Flash was giving. And, you know, it was like, okay, that was, you know, and my student was like, wow, you use three different languages to pull this off. I'm like, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the web today in general. I mean, and I think that's the difference, especially I've been dealing with, you know, people who I would consider more of traditional programming background. They learned C++, so they learned a hard structured language when they went through a computer science degree. But then you have people that are coming into it like, well, I want to create a web page that does this. They have no formal training, and they're like, oh, I'm going to take this piece of PHP, and I'm going to take this part of an action script in a Flash piece, and I'm going to take some SQL, and I'm going to mix it together. And it's a different way of thinking about programming, and I think that's the interesting way that, in general, the environment is headed, is that it's no longer about, you know, a single language, like you said. It's about utilizing multiple technologies, like you did in your example.
Yeah.
And actually figuring out, how do I solve the problem? Don't box yourself in by saying, I have to do it entirely in this language. Now, there are reasons why you might want to do that, and those are good exercises. But if you're really trying to solve a problem, don't limit yourself to a single point of view a lot of times. And yeah, if you think in those creative ways beyond, like, well, if I'm trying to write an ASCII program and I want it to do something, can I rely on other things to help me there? Or do I have to do it entirely in ASCII if I'm really getting down to the metal, in essence?
Typing is always the way. All right, so one of the best ways that I know how to learn about something is to take an existing thing apart and go look at how they made that whatever. And there's a lot of great code everywhere. I mean, if you want to, you could type example Xcode examples, for example. You could type in HyperCard examples. It doesn't absolutely matter what it is that's there. But what happens is, if you find a completed whatever, open it up and just see what it was that made it. And if in the case of Xcode stuff, there's one of the examples that comes with the code is a text editor.
Right.
And you open this up and there's like no code in it. Because there's literally like 10 lines of code, because the way that Mac OS,
it just instantiates a text editor widget. Yeah. And there you go.
It's just this object called it's a text editor window.
Yeah.
And then when you save it, you basically grab the instant the that put that, yeah, and put it somewhere else.
Right.
And so literally there is like 8 lines of code in that. The good thing about this is that as a programmer, you're not having to write a whole class or a whole thing that is text editor. You can think, oh, I need a text editor. Okay, drag that there. Okay, I'm done with that. Right. Now you can use that as the other thing for the rest of your code. Concentrate on what the real problem is, whatever it is that you're trying to do.
One of the foundations, and this is, you know, the foundations of many operating systems, languages that have growing or long-standing libraries that allow you to do one thing or another, that the language itself has a set of tools that are usually fairly spare. It depends on the language itself. But then on top of that are these libraries that provide you with all these functions that you don't have to write, which is fantastic. And the frameworks, if you're doing Mac OS 10 programming or whatever, you've got frameworks that allow you to write to the video, write to the audio without having to take care of the low-level details. So it is great that you can, depending on the language, the first thing you want to be looking at is, has someone written a module or a set of tools that I can use to not have to do as much of the low-level stuff as I might have to if I was completely writing from scratch?
Well, like, so here's some examples. I might want to create a folder. I might want to write a file or read a file. I might want to see if a file exists. I might want to go and get the type and creator of the file. So in these instances, I don't want to have to recreate that code, and I don't want to maintain that code. I just want to go, ooh, I need that.
Right.
And then that becomes the function call that I use for the rest of the stuff that I've got going.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when I was working on one of the projects that I worked on long ago, I needed a component that downloaded things from the web and saved them into a folder.
Mm.
And so I couldn't find this. This was would have been, 1994 when I was writing this. So I wrote the library, and I ended up using that code for 7 years after I wrote it. And, you know, I probably made 4 or 5 changes to it over the years, but that was something that just lived in all my projects forever.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
JavaScript libraries are one that is sort of a ready example that is they're getting very mature as well. There's the one that I've been using most recently is called jQuery. And JavaScript as a language gives you all the tools that you want to do all the fancy Web 2.0 stuff, fading stuff in and out, and accordion, expanding contract type stuff. But the jQuery library and libraries like it allow you to figure out what on the page you want to grab using standard CSS selectors. So if you've got a class called a list item, you can in one line say, grab me all the things that are of the class list item, and then dot do whatever with it.
Oh, wow.
Including fade in, fade out, go through them one at a time and highlight them, figure out their contents.
What about Blink?
It's got Blink. Yeah, Blink's, it wouldn't Blink. Be a fully fledged library without some sort of Blink. Sure, a very fast fade in, fade out would probably suffice.
Yeah. No, that's not the same thing as just turning it off and on, and, you know, every 100 milliseconds.
That's a great example, though, that it's the instead of spending all of your time figuring out how to make a really great fade in or fade out effect with raw JavaScript, you're using this pre-existing library and doing what you need to do. What does your page need to do? And it's just a single sort of fade this in, fade this out, as opposed to writing all that from scratch. Very powerful.
Libraries are awesome.
Well, the thing about that sometimes too is, I mean, I take advantage of libraries all the time for doing stuff. But at the same time, you have to sometimes think in the way the person that created that library thinks. So an example of this is the one that I've been, you know, that drove me a little crazy when I first started working with Automator. You know, in a sense, Automator is its own language, its own structure. But there's a part about Automator that is not necessarily, at least for me, intuitive the way the programmers created it. And that's if you create a folder and you have a follow-on folder creation structure inside that, it starts doing all this weird, seemingly recursive folders, creating within folders, creating within folders, and you get this nasty tree structure. And to me, that was counterintuitive. So sometimes taking advantage of the pre-existing stuff, you have to think that it might not work the way you intend it to. It's designed to work the way someone else intended it to. If you're thinking in that same direction and it's clearly documented, then it might make sense, and you taking advantage of it will help you. But sometimes taking advantage of those libraries can throw you in the wrong direction, and you can get stuck in just using that.
That's why we don't end up with a single library for a single. It, almost invariably, there are, except for the stuff that's really long-standing and mature, there's always a competing implementation where someone has decided, well, that's not the way I would have written it, so I write it this other way.
I had this library that I didn't like. I didn't like the way the parameters got loaded, so I just made my own function. Called something similar, and I passed it the three functions or the three things that I needed, and then it loaded in it into the correct place in this 16 parameter function call. And then,
you wrapped it essentially.
Yeah, I wrapped it. It was like, okay, now I can use this because it's way easier to think about, and I'm never going to get an error back because it's going to load it up the correct way every single time.
Right. Yeah, that's a super powerful concept. The idea that you can take anybody else's code and you can write a wrapper around it that maybe. Well, that's going to call the underlying thing that you're using, but it does all the stuff that you might need specifically for your function or application. Or if you might be swapping the underlying thing out over time, like charge credit card might be a function that you're going to put in, but you might be starting out using a PayPal call, and it might be a Google checkout thing another time or whatever.
Right.
So the idea.
But you always call it.
You always call it charge credit card, and it just, based on where your code's at a given time, it figures out what it's going to do under the hood.
Well, I guess that can save you so much time later on, because you basically, you know, wrapper into wrapper means that, okay, I'm not having to go and find 85 instances of where charge credit card is used, and I might have one that, oops, I've missed, and it's actually calling charge credit card 2 instead of charge credit card 1 or 3 or whatever it is.
Well, and again, that's a great example of object-oriented programming. You know, people ask, what is object-oriented programming? And that's a simple example right there, is that you're letting that object do something regardless of what code is internal
to it. I got to correct myself. Never call something charge credit card 1, charge credit card 2. No, it's like charge credit card underscore PayPal.
Yes. Yeah, hopefully not 1 or 2.
Yeah, and then underneath the comment, like, this is the implementation from 2008 in February that fixes the new API that got corrected.
And you know what? You just brought up a great point, John.
What's that?
You brought up a great point that a lot of times beginning programmers don't do, and I try to get them to do and understand why it will help them later, is comment their code.
Yeah, you got to comment your code, because you know what? You're not doing it for your now self. You're doing it for your future self.
Your stupid 6 months from now, I don't remember a thing that I did self.
When did I write this?
Yeah. Who wrote this crap? What
moron made this happen? I can't even believe this compiles.
Yeah, that's what's the, I don't remember exactly. The adage, I think, is just that code is read way more times than it's written. So saving yourself a few keystrokes going in and naming all your variables A, B, C, charge credit card 1, 2, 3. Those are the sorts of things you'll end up kicking yourself for later.
Yeah, and I'm going to get, we can go one more and go, you know how it might be a good idea to copy paste something? So you copy some code and you paste it right underneath as the next function call to fix it, but then you name it like just by adding the number, but then you don't leave the code, the comment about it. You're like, so why did I do this? Yeah. And can I delete the other one? I'll just leave them both here because I don't know.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, commenting is one of those sort of seemingly menial tasks that only seems that way until you run into the first instance of either someone else's code or your own where you didn't say why you did that thing, and then you're suffering for it.
Or don't be afraid to delete it. Like, this happens all this time with web stuff that I fix. Someone will leave in the old PHP.
Oh.
Right? They just comment it all out, and you're like, okay, so then you're reading it, and you're like, okay, this didn't work. I'm like, why didn't you just delete this? Why am I even looking at this?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then, so you're going down the list, and you're like, well, here's why the problem doesn't work. You know, and then...
On the one hand, that's great, because they left you this sort of archaeological record of why it was failing. Yeah. On the other hand...
I don't need to know that.
Yeah, and you wonder whether or not that's something that's going to need to get turned back on at some time in the future.
Yeah, because there's no notes there or anything.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like when you do, you know, like when the guys come and do the phone patch stuff, and they don't leave a breadcrumb.
Right.
They don't put the card on the wire that says, here's where we put the fax. So that when it stops working 4 days later because the wire got broken, you're like, okay, where's the fax? You know, they're like, and the phone guys are of the mind of, well, I'll just put the signal generator on here, and I'll take my wand and go over the phone patch panel and find it. Okay, that's an okay way to debug something, right? When you know nothing about it, right? You're basically just doing it brute force. When in fact, if they would have just put a map and a label there, they could have said, oh, the fax isn't working. Oh, that's patch panel 42. Mm-hmm. Oh, the wire's loose. No thinking about that.
One of the, to me, the easiest to implement sort of breadcrumb trails for you is, because they're so easy to use now, source control systems like Subversion.
Mm-hmm.
When you're working on a project, you can, every time you check something, and so the idea is that you've got this database of your code at a given state, and then you make some changes to a file and you check it in. But the thing that it makes you do when you're doing that is you have to leave a comment. You have to say, what did I do to this file that's different now? So in addition to any sort of formal commenting you might do, it keeps you from leaving a bunch of old junk, because you know if you need that old junk that you just deleted from this file, you can go back and look at the previous versions and grab it again.
Yeah, well, a good example is the MacBreak Tech RSS feed.
Who wrote
what
this
about
crap?
It, John?
It's like every single time there's a problem with it. And the thing that's funny is that all my other podcasts, I don't have a single problem with. It's just because we changed the name from MBT to MBKT.
And it didn't stick.
And it didn't stick. And there's some files that are on my computer that are still MBT.
Right.
Oh, it's so... I just want to...
We're transitioning from one RSS feed management system to another, and in the meantime, we're working in flat file land, and it's been causing John grief. I owe him at least 5 beers.
Every single time. Oh, it's the worst. But anyway, it just goes to show you that, you know, that even though it's not code... That the version control stuff has been there. If we needed to roll it back right away to something else, the old feed is there.
And when something goes wrong, you quickly do what's called a diff, where it just shows you exactly what lines have changed between one and two, and you can see MBT or MBT.
Yeah, it's like there's a space in that. Yeah. Well, no wonder it doesn't work. space in the file name. Can't have a space in the file name. By the way, whoever decided that a space in a file name was a bad thing back in 1966, because it probably was back then. You have to remember that a space is just an ASCII character, like any other character. Why you decided to differentiate it as something different, I don't know. Come on.
I'm sure there was some good reason for it.
There's no good reason for it. If you go look at an ASCII chart, you know, and you see all these characters, every one of them has a number. Why was that one different?
I bet there's a comment in some file somewhere, like #. Well, this isn't exactly optimal, but we're going to have to go with it. The whole computing landscape changed forever.
Illegal characters, you know, #, and $ and all that. Like, why are those illegal?
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's just another number of the character. It's like, I don't, maybe
well,
they were,
and actually,
maybe there was a real reason for it, and some code historian will go and tell us what that it's about. Because, you know, sometimes when we get stuff wrong, they chime in.
I wonder if it had something to do with systems that were parsing input line by line, and there was some special meaning attached to those characters that they wouldn't have been able to differentiate, like a space between arguments when you're calling a function.
Right. Well, I know that when I wrote my parser, I wrote a basic interpreter in 2002, in the month of March. I'd never written one, right? And it's the total. It's every computer sci person has had to do this, write an interpreter, and so. I decided that, okay, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I decided. I woke up one morning, I'm like, I want to write BASIC.
Oh my gosh.
Great example.
And I want to be done on April 1st. And I want to release it on April 1st. You know, it was like, here's the ultimate joke, right? Sure. You go to my webpage and there's this blinking cursor and you type in run and nothing happens. And then you type in 10, print, hello world, return 20, end, or 20, go to 10, and then type run, and the hello world just continuously prints on your in your web page. But I do know that I had some choices that I needed to make in the design of the language, and one of them was that a space was a really important character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you couldn't just have 10, no space, and then a character. Mm-hmm.
It's delimiting your tokens,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's delimiting your tokens. And if you don't do that, then there was no way of figuring out what was what. And, you know, it was one of those things. And, like, I went ahead and counted spaces. When you pressed return after entering it, it did a validation of your your code. And so it took out extra spaces. So that if you had 10 space, 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 and then 4 x equals 1 to 20...
Sure.
And there was a bunch of extras, you know, any of them got rid of them,
mm-hmm.
you know, for readability and for my ability to then parse that command and go on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. But I learned a lot from that project. I mean, talk about, you know, I mean, here I am already knowing how to be a programmer, mm-hmm. but I decided that, okay, I need to have I'm going to have to write a parser to figure out what that command or what that line of code is.
Okay.
I had to come up with a clever way of dealing with variables, you know, that were in my engine. And then I needed to write a math engine, you know, so that it balanced the equations correctly. And essentially what I did there is cheated. I figured out where it was, how the variables or how the math was supposed to get loaded. Mm-hmm. And then I just chucked it off to the math engine on the compiler that I was already running.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's
perfectly
fine.
Valid.
Yeah, it's perfectly valid. But the thing was is that in order to get it to do that, I needed to be able to, you know, be able to move these things around. So if somebody loaded it so that it would, because math has operation needs to go multiplication first, division right, next, order of operations, and it has to go that way. Otherwise, you'll get the wrong answer. And then if you have stuff that's in parens, that needs to get processed before the other stuff. And you kind of have to. It's a tree, and it's kind of fun. If you go and look at this, you take this long equation, and essentially what happens is you'll get it down to a couple of of operators. And I had so much fun learning about that. And then, so the math engine, that took a while, but the one that was even more fun was the Turtle Graphics, right? Just writing the...
What was the name of that? That wasn't Logo, was it?
Logo, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The thing where you turn the turtle and, yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, I didn't want to write a graphics engine per se. I just wanted to write, I wanted something simple that you could basically do all kinds of stuff. So I said, well, turtles are easy. So I wrote a turtle graphics engine.
Nice.
And, then there was a whole bunch of stuff that goes like, so pen up, pen down, go to an absolute position on the screen, go to a random position, not go to a random.
Relative.
Yeah, relative. Yeah. So there was specific, and then there was relative, and I don't know, it was just a ton of fun. And then the stuff that people were doing with that, as I was developing it, they're like, oh, can we have this command? I'm like, sure. Then 2 days later, there's my command.
Yeah. Your comment earlier about the cheat made me realize something. I don't know why this came up just recently for me, but I was reading something that was talking about user interface design, because a lot of times one of the common conceits of some programmers is that it can be so much fun to hack at the innards of something, and there can be a sometimes Herculean effort to get a certain piece of functionality going the way that you want, but that's all under the hood. With all the user sees, if your application is something that a user is going to interface with, and a lot of them are, especially if it's web-based stuff or whatever, to the user, the application is the interface.
Right.
All they see is what buttons do you expose, what does the screen do, what's the refresh time like, all those sorts of things. And so the fact that you're utilizing some other library or you wrote it from scratch, from that perspective, cheating is almost always the way you want to go. If cheating means you're going to use somebody else's pre-existing piece of machinery to make your thing go,
right.
Because what you care about is getting something that the folks can use,
right,
that works and get it as soon as possible.
Well, especially if you use a library and you find out that library sucks, and if you've used it correctly, you can rip it out and you can put a new one in, and the users are going to go, dude, this rocks now.
Right.
It looks exactly the same.
And you chuckle and say, I cheated.
I cheated. Cheated death. Let's talk about, this is fun. There's a bunch of different languages that we can talk about from a using point of view. And one of the obvious ones is BASIC, which is Beginner's All-Purpose Symbolic Instruction Set. This is
one of my favorites.
No, it's not instruction set. It's, what does C stand for? Instruction.
Compiler?
No. Code.
Command.
Code. Yeah, code, command. All right. Well, anyway.
I think it just ends with C.
Oh, no, it is code. No, it doesn't just end with C. Yeah. Beginner's all-purpose. Everyone should use C. but it's amazing to me how many basic interpreters and compilers there still are for these Macs.
I remember a series of basic commands that were in these books. This is super nerd little land here, but some, they were not kids' novels I remember reading, and they every, I don't know, 50 pages or so, the story had something like they were a spy and they needed to see what was on the screen, and for you to see what was on the screen, you had to type in this 25 lines of basic, and it would give you something or whatever.
Oh, cool.
It was a part
I
of the story.
Those.
Do you remember those? I don't remember what they were called.
I do remember those. I think they were from the company that made Choose Your Own Adventures.
That sounds familiar, but they're really good.
I probably have some of those books somewhere buried in my old archive of stuff from a kid.
Yeah, for learning the basic sort of flow of control stuff and just laundry list style programming, was do this line, do this line, do this line. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a, you can pick up a lot of bad habits from using this, but if this is your very first entry into programming, there's nothing wrong with that. Anyway, the one that I'm going to bring up, there's actually three of them that we're going to recommend. The one I recommend is called Chipmunk Basic. It runs on everything. And it's essentially a command line style terminal emulator based program that you know, you type in all your commands with a line number, and when you're done typing it, you type run, and it'll either work or not work.
Right.
The thing that's fun about this is that it's this specific one supports QuickTime MIDI, speech synthesis, AppleScript, network sockets, pipe, serial I/O, and even some rudimentary object-oriented programming kind of stuff. So they've kept it up. Thing that's fun about this is that you can run this on a Mac Plus if you had one. Because it's basic. It's not a lot of overhead. And the thing that's fun with this is that if you're trying to, you know, if you've got kids that you're trying to teach, this is a really easy tool to use because there's so, there's so many examples of things that you can type into it. Like you're talking about the adventure, right? And you, and this is the coolest part about this. You're typing this program in. It's 25 lines of code. You accidentally learn from doing this. Because it's a rote situation. You're learning about typing. You're learning about, you know, making sure that you're reading correct.
I was just going to say, it doesn't work first time. Yeah, you got to go back and see which line you got wrong.
Right. Yeah. You type run and it goes beep, error in line 20. You're like, ah. And you go back and read line 20 and it's like, oh, I forgot the quotes. I forgot the parens. I got the I got a paren here and a bracket there. So you're getting the idea of debugging down while you're doing this. And the best part about Chipmunk Basic or Basic in general, these terminal types, is that they will fail right off. They'll just they won't keep going. Whereas a compiler, you may have a compiler error that may take. You may spend days trying to figure out that you forgot the semicolon at the end of page 54.
Yeah, it seems like always. For folks who are just getting into it, it always seems like, in my opinion, a better idea to start with something interpreted than to go with something compiled, because it's just one less thing to learn. The whole what group of files am I compiling into an executable? How do I fire the compiler? And what get out of it? All that sort of mitigated by the fact that you're just typing into a terminal
or command prompt. And that's a great – and that's something that a lot of times people don't understand the difference between even compiled and interpreted. Meaning, you know.
Well, I'm going to say anymore that the computers are so fast that it's pretty tough to tell the difference.
Right.
Yeah. It depends on the application, of course. Right.
When I was doing a lot of work with Director for building these, we built so much for corporate America using this thing. And at some point, I remember where Director went from being slow and really pathetic in its performance to being like, "Well, this is really good." Yeah. Like, there's no difference between, you know, if I would have done this in C or if I would have done this in here or in Director, because there was no difference.
Right. Well, even things like I did my final, I think I've talked about this before, but I did my final computer science program in college in HyperCard.
Oh, yeah.
Because the professor said, you can write the program in any language you want. Just assuming we were going to use the Unix terminals at the lab, but he said, you can write in any language you want as long as it does the following things and meets all the goals, then you're fine. So I went and did HyperCard, and I printed out my program, and I had screenshots, and I had user interface buttons and all this kind of stuff. And he's like, what's this? I said, this is my program. And he was expecting you just know lines of code, and I'm giving him GUIs and buttons and all kinds of stuff. Because I chose, I can go this direction. I can make it an interpreted language, which is what HyperCard was in essence, you know. And in my opinion, one of the first really good object-oriented languages too. But yeah, systems have become so fast now that, you know, unless you're doing mission-critical, I got to make sure this works and it's got to work flawlessly and things like that on a mass scale, interpreted languages are great now.
Right.
And there's always been a bit of FUD about scripting or interpreted languages versus, putting in air quotes here, real languages, which usually means compiled languages. And if you think of your aim as being you want to be as productive as possible, you want to get as much tool written in a short amount of time as you can, the truth is that all the proliferation of these languages has democratized the ability to get into programming and make these tools happen yourself. It's no longer just PhDs on a military mainframe sort of thing.
Right.
And if you need to write something that is rock solid. You can write rock solid code in any language that's available to you. It has everything to do with how you're using it and the architecture of what you're building and how carefully you're building it.
Right.
It's when you're choosing a language, there's no reason to feel like you're getting boxed in by choosing whatever you choose first, because you can always switch once you learn the fundamentals. And B, you can port code. If you find out that one little piece of code isn't running fast enough in your interpreted language, you can make a compiled version of that is called by the interpreted language,
right.
and take advantage of the speed or robustness or whatever it is you're looking for.
Just right. Before we get too much further, I just want to shout out that Future Basic is now a freeware program. So this,
oh, really?
Yeah, it used to be $199, then it was $99, then it was something less. But this is a basic that's compiled. It's pretty. It's like all of these tools, become as Python and Ruby and
JavaScript
and whatever it is become more prolific. This thing, which made a lot of money for them at the time, is gonna wither, go away, change. The business model of all this changes. Let's talk about Kenji brought up HyperCard, so let's talk about the modern version of HyperCard.
I love my HyperCard.
Yeah, well, you can't have it. No, actually you can. There's a couple of tools that are really good at taking the HyperCard model to the point of keeping the verbosity of the language the same, put this into that concept, which actually I don't like anymore. I was at one point very comfortable typing that. Now I'm like, no, I don't want to type. Like, I don't want to use that mode, those verbs anymore. But anyway, there's SuperCard, which basically was born out or SuperCard.
It was undead.
It was undead, right? SuperCard was dead, then it was dead, and then it was undead, and now it's walking again. They cured it. And it basically has a method of taking old HyperCard stacks and then pulling them into the future, into this tool. And the thing that's fun about SuperCard is that it always was HyperCard 1 better. Because it had same scripting language, but they had concepts of layers on it. They had concepts of being able to talk to things on the internet, so it could talk to FTP and HTTP, and it could open up a terminal session and do stuff. It was a really powerful tool. The problem was that the guys chased forever the idea that it needed to run on Windows, because the market said, hey, we need it to run on Windows. So this is where its downfall was that because it was so tied into the Mac that it just wasn't able to move forward.
Yeah, but there were a bunch of people with old HyperCard applications that really needed to run them on
education.
Okay.
So all this education curriculum got made in HyperCard, but it was just not able to get moved to those other things. And so out of that...
They hadn't rewritten Oregon Trail yet?
They've rewritten Oregon Trail. It's a Facebook app now.
Actually, I think Oregon Trail runs on every application platform known to man now.
It's like the de facto test suite for getting something done in a given language.
So then there's another tool that's actually pretty good from Revolution. Runrev.com is the place to get that. They have a 30-day trial that you can try out. But that is a very card-like environment. And I've looked at this a bunch of times. Just for this one app that Alex keeps asking us to write, and I'm like, we could probably write this in about a day in Revolution.
Okay,
Runtime Revolution, right?
Yeah, it's Runtime Revolution.
The company's the website's Runrev.
Yeah, it's Runrev. It's a really cool thing. It runs on absolutely everything. So you can make a binary that runs on Unix, Unix, Linux. What's that other OS? Windows.
That one.
And then Mac OS 10 and 9. So if you need to go back that far, you can make the binaries that'll run on all that just from the one application that's running.
Okay.
So you don't have to have a Windows machine and a Solaris machine and all that to make the binaries. You just make, say, I'm going to publish this. And
you install that runtime on whatever platform. There's a runtime version for each of those destination
OSs. So the Windows gets an exe, the Unix machine gets a dot whatever, and the Mac doesn't get anything except for the triangle. I mean, the rectangle. I mean, the square that you double click. And so there you go. You can publish that. Thing that's fun about that is that you can do a lot of things with about no code at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a ton of examples of stuff. If you want to make a tool that sends things to an FTP site, then, you know, on a daily basis, you can write that in 10 lines of code. And off you go.
Well, we're talking about languages that are easy to get into. You know me, I'm always banging the Python drum, but especially for folks getting into it, you open up your terminal and you type the word Python and you're in a Python shell, and you can start typing things like A=1, B=2, A+B, all that sort of low level calculatory stuff that you might want to do when you're first starting.
That's what's cool about Python, is that it pretends to be a compiler. Or it's a scripting language.
Right.
But it has an environment that you can be interactive in.
That's right. Yeah, the console environment.
Yeah.
Definitely worth checking out.
Well, what's interesting, too, is we're talking about example code that you can go and tear apart. And we've talked about before, is that when you install the developer's kit that comes with your Mac OS, is that you have this entire examples folder that has everything from Perl to Python to Java, OpenGL, Ruby, even examples of how you use the IO kit on the OS to do different input and output. I mean, you've got all these great examples right there, or the Xgrid or widgets, all those kind of things.
Yeah, the example applications that come with Xcode are a great place to start if you want to do anything that ties into the frameworks that are just sitting there on your Mac waiting to be taken advantage of.
In fact, I think that's where there it is. The QuickTime player kit is actually there. So if you want to build your own QuickTime player, they basically give you the base code for building your own QuickTime player.
You can build Oregon Trail in the QuickTime player now.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit. We talked about BASIC. Let's talk about game development tools.
Game development. OpenGL.
No, I don't want to talk about OpenGL.
Oh,
too low level?
Too low level. That's no place for anybody to start. That's just...
No,
I mean, you'll spend 5 years doing stuff.
Go mod something on one of the big engines like Quake 3 or...
Yeah.
I will say this. One of the companies
Unreal
I worked
Tournament.
For, we had a great tool that let you build an entire interface entirely in the GUI, write mathematical logic pieces, and you hit a button and output all the OpenGL code and associated code that went with it. It was a great tool.
Yeah, well, now the kids are going to want a link to it.
Yep.
Sorry, can't have it.
If you can even find the company who's bought it and bought it again, and if it even still exists, it was called Designer's Workbench back in the day. It was a great tool.
If you don't want to find that, there's two really great tools that you can use for doing 3D game applications, and one of them is the Torque game engine.
Yep.
And that's from garagegames.com. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, you can download it, you can play with it, you can see all the code to the engine. You don't have to pay them anything.
Yeah, didn't they used to charge $100 a seat or something like
that? They still do, right?
If you want to publish a game,
it costs you $100.
Yeah.
But just to go and demo and play and see, you don't owe them anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is a really good way to do it. And the thing that happens with that is that, you know, your barrier to go check it out is nothing.
Yeah.
You just have to have the curiosity and the idea that I want to make a game. And it comes with an example game that you can go and open up and see and go from there.
And you get all the things like a physics engine. I don't know which one they're using these days, but they used to be using that open, what is it, open...
Havoc? No,
No, that was a proprietary thing, wasn't it? Well, there was an open physics engine that was out there for a while that's been taken over, I think, by the PhysX engine in a lot of games.
But
in any case, Torque has a physics engine and all those sorts of things you can play with, which are great.
Well, and speaking of game engines, I think this is one John was going to bring up. I mean, Toric's been around a long time, and there's a huge development community around it. But on the Mac side, my favorite one now is Unity. I love this. You know, in fact, it would be great to get a hold of a copy. I've only ever played with the demo versions, but just playing with the demo version has been a great experience, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, I keep looking at this. I'm like, I'm not downloading it today.
I know, made that mistake.
I'll disappear for 30 days.
Yeah.
You won't see me.
Yep.
Which may not be a bad
2 days.
Thing, but
I spent an entire weekend. I downloaded it and started diving into it. Next thing I know, it's like Sunday evening. I'm like, okay, I got to stop.
Do you know of any have any major games been built on Unity that we know of?
They do have a list.
The game Goo Ball from Ambrosia Software was built on Unity.
Oh, okay.
Freeverse, Tiki Magic Mini Golf, I think it is.
Isn't that
which was actually
Epic Tower Defense? That's not that. What's that one that Alex is addicted to?
Yeah,
that's Tower Defense.
Yeah, desktop
Tower
Defense. That's a Flash game.
Oh, okay, that's Flash.
But they, but somebody may have done a Tower Defense game using Unity.
The cool thing about Unity, in my opinion, and the new plugin is really nice, is that it even has a web embeddable 3D engine now. So you can build a game, you can embed into a web page, and it works across either in the web or as a standalone Mac or Windows game. So you can create a single game and actually have it work across multiple platforms.
And you only have to wait 3 weeks for it to download all the 3D assets so that your game world works.
Actually, if you go to their website, I was pretty impressed. The first time I tried it, I was on a pretty slow web connection, and it downloaded pretty fast.
The game that you were playing?
Yeah.
Well, what you have to do really is you have to make it really hard so that you have tons of time to be downloading all the assets for the next level as they're slogging their way through level one.
Or you put all this pre-story at the beginning that,
right.
You know, has a little interactivity, but mainly lets them watch something or slowly evolves as all that's coming down in the background.
Or you just design it so that the world starts out very simple and then it gets more complex with each level as you go. So you can...
Well, and realistically, that's what, you know, that's the Flash idea, right? Is that you start off with a small amount of data, just enough to get them into it, to pull them into whatever your world is, tease them.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the background, you're downloading all the massive amounts of data that you need to support this.
Yeah, but have you ever seen a Flash tool that's been, that does that correctly?
Yes, actually I have.
Yeah,
in fact,
like a couple of times, but nobody else seems to get the concept of this.
Yeah, no, most people are just like, they're on a 3 megabit broadband connection. They can handle the download.
Sure.
I was like,
I've always thought of a progress bar as sort of a little mini game that I get to sit there and watch and not do anything with. I don't know. Just me.
collective watching a progress bar.
Yeah.
Should figure out how much time has been wasted collectively by all the progress bars that have been watched. Somebody has to know this. There's another game. There's another garage games tool called Torque Game Builder. Not Torque. What's the side scroller that they did? It's a game. It's a game engine that helps you do side scrollers. It's part of Garage Games.
Oh, I thought it was Torque Builder or something like that.
Gotta look it up because I don't have my confuser in front of
me.
There's two. There's the game engine. So it is Torque Builder. There's the game engine SDK.
Yeah.
Right, so the Torque engine is the side-scroller.
Torque game engine, Torque game builder, yeah.
Yeah, there is that. I spent some time with it. I didn't do the game, though. I just wasn't going to get paid, so I'm like, all right, well, I'm not going to do it. See, that's some of my motivation to learn these things, is that someone will come to me and go, hey, we really want to do this. And so I'll invest, you know, 10 days, 5 days, you know, whatever it is to look at this. And I go, okay, yeah, we can do that product. We can make that happen for you. And then they'll give them a bid, and then they'll go, nah, it's too expensive. We'll go somewhere else.
Mm.
Or we don't really want to do that. You know, when the reality, they're like, oh, it's got to be easy. It's a game, right? I'm like, are you kidding me?
Right.
We got to do motion. We got to do bullet detection. We got to do wall detection. We got to do monsters. We got to have the art done. Then there's the soundscape that's got to be figured out. And, you know, and at some point, it's not even the programming anymore. It's all
it's
the assets.
Asset management. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all the assets that go with it.
That's part of what drives these big game budgets up, right? I mean,
you got
heavy hitters doing the engine development, but once they've got that, you still got to populate the world with stuff.
And right.
The making the pretty is, you know, if not more, at least as much work.
Yeah, well, that's what was happening with the kid who wanted to be the game design. You know, he wanted to make games. I'm like, so are you an artist? Well, no. Do you like fashion? No. Do you like architecture? No. Do you, you know, well, what do you like?
How do you feel about a game based on Wingdings? Because that's where you're at right now.
Because that's where you're at right now. And it was kind of funny to think about it in terms of all those things, you know. Fashion, architecture, history, mm-hmm. You know, all the stuff that you don't even consider to be gameplay.
Do you spend a lot of time thinking about what's fun? Because that's something that's, you know, oftentimes lacking in certain games.
Well, then just,
is it fun?
Yeah, is it fun? Then there was then he was like, well, how do I learn about games? I'm like, MAME.
Yeah.
You know, go download Pac-Man and Joust and Robotron. Although Robotron sucks because it needs the proper controller. But Joust is definitely playable on your keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, okay, I'm going to go do that. I'm like, all right, see you in 3 weeks.
You have to let us know how he does.
Yeah. Well,
did he say where he's going to start? What environment he's going to use?
Well, he didn't know because he'd never thought about what it took to make a game.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm like, well, okay. If we're just going to talk about programming a game, you know, open up Director or open up Flash, you know, and start doing those things like, How do I make the little dot? You know, in this case, don't even do any art. Just make a circle and then hook it up to the keyboard so that it goes to there. And it's like, what happens when it hits the screen, the edge of the screen? Do you bounce it or do you wrap around? Right? Or do you blow up?
Right.
You know, what's that? And then once you get the screen edge detection working, then you can start doing the same concept with the maze, which means you got to draw a maze. But... But then you can have that thing move around so that, okay, it stops when it gets to a corner until you say go another direction. Then you start putting the bad guys in there so that, you know, they chase you. And then what's my incentive to go around the maze? You know, I got to eat little dots. And so pretty soon, without even thinking about it, you've made Pac-Man.
Right.
Waka, 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 waka.
Well, and there are a lot of things that, you know, even people that do want to do art don't think that you have to learn what the technology is behind these things. How do you create the structures for this? You know, and a lot of times guys are like, oh, I just want to build, you know, game art and things like that. It's like, well, do you understand what the underlying graphics card is doing with a bump map so that you can properly create the bump map to take advantage of the hardware? And then the programmer is not going to yell at you because you've taken up too many resources and...
I always used to just get the art from the artist and then I dealt with it because I did. Yeah. It was just too complicated to explain it every time.
It seems like we're still in that strange medium space where the need to have knowledge of what a bump map is still there, but you want eventually over time to have the tools hide that stuff from you. I guess that's the end goal anyway, but we're definitely not there yet.
Right. Well, and that's true about most of these tools anymore, is that even though, you know, the ability to make these things simpler should all be there now, it's not there yet. I mean, there's a lot of things that could be done more simply and just haven't been done.
And in truth, some of this stuff, I mean, it's all knowable stuff too. We're not talking about super complex concepts. So you could make the argument that
the conversation already in progress is no longer being recorded because your disk is almost full. The recording will now stop.
All right, well, this is why you should always check your disk space. Oops. Oh, my gosh. Okay, and I really, really have to finish that one project because there was no reason for having to have this part.
Yeah, you got something big taking up your disk there.
Something. Well, no, I know which project it is. I did this video edit recently, and there was a DVD that got made, and there's a source file for that, and there's all of those things. So, while programming is really small, video is really big.
Yeah, right.
and that's the weird thing about, you know, the stuff that we do today is that, you know, tomorrow I may jump back into code. Yesterday I was doing DVDs and editing video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, text files are much lighter on the system. Mm-hmm. You got to have a lot of them to equal.
The thing is that if you have a big catastrophic disk failure, like we kind of did just now, you get to lose a lot of stuff. Well, anyway, I don't know exactly how that was going to end up, but I do know that it went... let's wrap this up because you got a train to go to. Kenji's got a dinner to go to, and I got opening to go to. So nice. Yeah, so let's just kind of wrap how this is going to go. I'm going to say this, is that, you know, does people learn different ways, and we've gotten a lot of Kenji and Ben. I was actually aiming at Ben, but we've had this discussion before about how people learn.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Some people learn best from a class. Some people learn best by taking a book and hitting the books and studying it. Mm-hmm. Some people learn by taking things apart. Some people learn by having somebody else show them stuff. You know, there's nothing wrong with any of those methods of learning.
Right.
I know that when I was the two times in my life when I've taught programming as a profession, which is kind of, you know, it's pretty cool. One was when I was 16 years old. I was teaching kids how to program in BASIC.
Okay.
And the thing that happened was that we would teach the kids to a point, and then the kids would teach the other kids. So there was always kids teaching kids. It was the coolest school in the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because basically you take the teacher out of the equation and everybody's moving really fast. And if you don't move fast, then, you know, that's okay too, because there's somebody else that's moving just the same speed slow that you are.
Yeah, that sharing is happening at super speed on net as well. Just the proliferation of information about any programming, library or language or domain within programming. Yeah, it's very easy to find your way, and you are learning from the other kids at that point.
Right. And when I say learning from the other kids, I mean, like, just hanging out with Ben, I learn a ton. Right, and just hanging out with the process is a really great way to make yourself learn about this. Mm-hmm. And if you don't understand something, you go, well, how do you do that? And someone will show you, like, here's how this works.
Yeah, well, in asking questions, I mean, going back to my Apple or the Automator problem, I was trying to figure out. I asked a question on one of the Apple Automator forums, and, you know, one of the engineers came back and said, well, that's the way we designed it. I was like,
right.
It's counterintuitive.
Yeah, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
So,
but I learned that by, you know, simply putting up that question on a forum saying, how does this work? It seems like it's a bug.
Yeah, access to the people who are creating this stuff is a fantastic sort of new development.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. When you can complain to the guy who can actually make your life better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
please fix your memory leak,
right,
so that it doesn't crash every 3.5 days.
It took up all our disk space and we lost half our show.
Yeah. Oh, that's my fault.
No, I want to blame the memory leak.
Oh yeah. You know, the thing, and we don't often recommend this anymore, but there's a ton of books. You know, O'Reilly has a great collection of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? Programming is one of those things where it's hard to replace having a book there sometimes. Emerging languages, you're not going to find good books. But languages that are already well established, they're great book resources. And it's great to have that book there. You can look at that example. You can read what it's telling you. And you can look at the screen. Now, some people don't like that, but I'm still one of those guys that I love to have a hard copy there.
The index is the most powerful thing in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you've sort of found your way into a particular domain and you're looking to just get those gaps filled in, even if you don't read the whole book, I find myself now buying a book specifically for 3 or 4 chapters that I know I'm going to focus on, because those are the things I don't know. And yeah,
you buy the book. I usually just go down to Barnes & Noble and check it out. I feel it's shoplifting in the coolest way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's intellectual shoplifting.
Oh, it's... If you get the time to sit there and read it in the store, absolutely.
Sometimes you just need that one breadcrumb to go, oh, that's how to do it. Right.
Yeah.
When I talk about breadcrumbs, that's like these things that you leave around or you find that help you on your way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in the JavaScript in the very beginning, there was no interpreter. Or excuse me, there was no debugger. And so it was really painful to try to fix your bug in the browser. And so you'd end up printing stuff to the screen as it went. So you go, oh, it got to here. Oh, it got to here. Oh, it got to, oh, it didn't get to there. Yeah. That must be the bug after
entered
that.
Forest. Found gingerbread house. Entered gingerbread house.
Got eaten. No, it never got to got eaten. Right. Something happened between entered gingerbread house and got eaten. Got to find that spot. So, the class is a good way to go if you're that kind of person. Personally, classes make me crazy. I will never go into the classroom again.
Classes are great if you get ad hoc access to the instructor or TA or whatever. If it's just sitting through lectures, it might not be. Yeah. It's not my favorite mode anyway. But if there's someone really smart teaching the class that you get to sort of ping with questions, then you may not be able to come up in the curriculum.
You can break out of that stand and deliver and have the interactivity, then it's really good. I used to, the second time when I was teaching programming, I taught to a bunch of art students who – these people didn't know anything. They didn't barely know. They barely knew how to tie their shoe. Mm. And if they did, they said, "Well, this is the way I'm going to do it. It's art." Mm. Anyway, they're not that bad, but might as well have been. And there's probably four of them that are listening right now. They're going, "Dude, don't make fun of me.
You just insulted your former students."
Exactly. Well, no, some of them were really bright, and then I always taught the class to them, like Ben was saying. Yeah. It's like, okay. There's 20 of you who all have deer in the headlights look. Mm-hmm. And then there's two of you that are engaging. Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm talking with you two. Mm. I don't care about the other people because they're never going to understand it. Mm. And that's that really hit home with me, is that there are people in the world that will never be able to write a line of code. Because they just don't – it's just intellectually impossible to them.
I don't know. I haven't met anyone yet that couldn't go to at least a basic level. I would agree that there are certain types of that abstraction we were talking about earlier, to be able to take something that doesn't have any sort of physical analog or something that you can tie it to in the real world to help you make up your mental model of it, something that really just needs to remain abstract. That can be a difficult leap for some folks.
I'm going to stand by my thesis.
You think?
Yeah, I think so. There's just people that should not code.
That's what we should do. We should find people who cannot code and have the great challenge.
The great non-code off.
That's right. Can they or can they not write a line?
One line.
We will see.
10.
Over the next 12 episodes.
10. Print. Open.
Can't finish line.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm sure that there's somebody. They're going to, all these guys are going to offer up their GF or their W or their... Are there other significant other in this problem? We go, see, she can't code. Then there's all these other, there's all these women that are going to go, check out my boyfriend. He can't code.
That's
either.
Right.
Yeah.
He stays at home and makes me pie.
To how many decimal places?
I want someone to stay at home and make me pie. That's what I'm really getting at.
Pie would be good. All right, let's see. What else do we have? So, all right, well, go check out Hello World in 199 languages. The link for that will be in the page on macbreaktech.com for you to find. You can see the biggest Hello World on Earth in Flickr. There's the History of Programming Languages on the O'Reilly site, which is worthwhile downloading and printing, actually. You can look at it on the screen, but it's way cooler to print. There's 2,500 languages to choose from. We'll make sure to have the link to all of them there. It's actually one link, not 2,500. I'm not checking 2,500 links.
Isn't that what a database is for?
That's right.
Still not checking all those links.
Not even the robot.
Not even.
And try one of those. Try something.
Yeah,
especially if you're new or just getting into it. We would love to hear as you try and do maybe your first project, or at least just explore the language. Let us know what you run into. Was it the where do I run it? Was it the syntax of the language? Was it not having the documentation or finding examples that were relevant? Interested in what you run into as you start down the
Couldn't
path.
Find the link. For downloading Xcode from your DVD installer.
Yeah. Couldn't figure out how to download the show that told you to try something and tell us about your experience.
Right.
Things like that.
Quartz Composer was too weird for you.
Yeah.
Also go to 3am.com and check out 3B, the programming language that I wrote. There's a wiki. If you click on the help button, it'll take you to all the commands. I documented.
Although there's a little caveat with your website there, John.
Yeah. Okay, so if you have an Intel Mac, and most of you probably do because it's been out for 2 years now. Isn't that kind of cool? You have to run Safari in Rosetta emulation mode in order to make it work, because the thing was compiled in Shockwave, and there's no Intel-ified version of Shockwave, not until March 8th.
Right. Right.
So hurry up, March 8th. Can't wait. Can fix that problem once and for all. All right. Well, anything else you want to talk about programming-wise?
Nope. Excited to hear what people run into.
Me too. I wish we would have had enough disk space. That's the only thing I wish for.
Next time, John. Next
no,
time.
There's no next time. See, that's the whole problem. It's never as good the second time.
Yeah.
And now we can't record the second show.
We'll do it next week.
Next time. Speaking of next time, I'm John Foster.
I'm Ben Durbin.
And I'm Ken Giacotto.
And we'll see you on the other side. Yeah, again.
Hello, world. Hello. Again.
Again.
Hello, world. Hello, world. Hello, world.